Welcome to the Hometown Hollywood Podcast, where you can find advice, inspiration, and strategies for success from talented people that are making a name for themselves inside the film industry, but outside of major film cities. Here's your host, Travis Myers. I also hate the sound of my voice more than like any other noise in the world, so I just know I'm going to cringe.
I love the sound of your voice. I don't know what you're talking about.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You are the only person in the world to say that, which lets me know you're a liar.
Hello, my name is Travis Myers, and this is the Hometown Hollywood Podcast. Today's guest is John Carrington III, a DP and colorist in Greenville, South Carolina. Per John's request, I added the explicit tag to the cover art of this episode, even if it isn't actually an explicit interview. As I mentioned in the show, this interview was filled with aha moments for me, and I'm so glad to have this conversation recorded so I can reference back to it. If you're needing some inspiration to progress your own film career, look no further than this interview. In this episode, you'll get a behind-the-scenes look at his work on Matthew Rojas's short film, Diva. I was actually able to work G&E on this film, and I got to see an early cut, and I think that Matthew and John were able to make real art together on this project. Go ahead and follow them on social media now, because this is a film you won't want to miss.
Diva will be coming to a screen near you on September 27th, 2021, so mark your calendars.
Hopefully that's enough hype. We'll also talk about John's early days dealing blackjack, the experience of having two mega churches fight over you, free trips to China, shooting a film in Mongolia with available light, how being a colorist helped him make relationships in the industry, how investing in personal projects can lead you to a national commercial, the importance of being inspired by what you shoot with, taking jobs outside your comfort zone, aha moments, working with Dylan Hahn on Rollin Lewis's music video, Wait, what it's like living in Greenville, South Carolina, and surprising his local citizens that he actually lives there. John is just the man, and I'm so glad he was able to take time out of his busy schedule to be on the show. But as a warning, knowledge bombs will be dropped. So we'll get right into the show after a word from our sponsor. This episode of the Hometown Hollywood Podcast is brought to you by the Original Knocky. Have you ever needed a knock on wood, only to find there's no wood available? Well, fear no more, because knock knock, who's there? The Original Knocky, a portable piece of wood that goes wherever you go, hollowed out for supreme knockability. This means you no longer have to carry around that cumbersome 2x4 or that chainsaw carving of a bear. Don't knock it till you try it, but you can't try it till you knock it. Secure yours today at knocky.co. John Carrington III, thank you so much for being on the show today.
No problem. Glad to be here.
This episode is a little bit different because this is the first time I've actually worked with one of my guests before I've had them on the show. And when I say worked with, I mean I was there while you worked, and I just kind of watched and lift heavy stuff every once in a while.
I mean, we put you to work. We couldn't have done it without you. We appreciate the hands you gave.
But that was a fun experience, and I got to see things I've never seen before.
What are some things that you never saw before?
I never saw an orbiter.
Oh, yeah.
That's for sure. I've never seen a giant, what's it called? Truss 8x8, 12x12 softbox rig with Titan tubes.
Yeah, I think we did 8x8 moon box. Yeah.
That was exciting. It was also terrifying because the wind was blowing really hard.
Yeah, and the rain.
And it weighed like 6,000 pounds. So
they made it safe. I mean, I told them, you know, as with anything, like, hey, the second you feel like this isn't safe, we'll go with a different solution. But they kept on top of it. So,
yeah, it was tied down to a truck most of the time. So I didn't think it was going anywhere.
Was that your first time shooting on film, like being around like a actual film?
That was my first time ever. I never went to film school or anything, so I never had the required make a little short film with Super 8 or whatever it is. So that was the first time, and it was very interesting. It was not what I thought, and it seems like a hassle to work with, but from what I've seen, it looks incredible.
I totally agree. It's a hassle when you're coming from digital. The hassle is it slows you down, which to me isn't really a hassle. It's nice. You know, because you're not just like, go, 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 shot, shot, shot. It's like, oh, we have a limit to what we can shoot now, you know, especially on 35, you know, we only had 4.5 minutes a mag. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, we only have so many rolls and we have all this stuff to get to and we're shooting multiple days. So let's make sure that we're getting good takes each time. And I really like how it slows you down, because sometimes, you know, in digital, it's just like roll, roll, roll. And, you know, you got like, you know, 8 minute takes, but they just keep going and going and going. And it's just like, man, can we cut and like evaluate if we want to, you know, keep rolling, or, you know, do we just, we're just going to burn through data like crazy.
Yeah. Feel bad for the editor afterwards.
Well, it was Matthew. So,
oh, he can do that.
Yeah. He can only be mad at himself.
Yeah. Do you prefer one or the other? Do you prefer shooting on film or digital?
No, I think it depends on the project. Each one is, you know, it's just kind of what suits it. You know, I do lots of jobs where film would just be completely impractical, but I really do enjoy shooting film, and I want to shoot more. And so as projects kind of come through that are like, man, this feels like this could be a good one for it, that'd be awesome. You know, I also haven't shot, you know, tons and tons and tons of films. So there is a little bit on my end, like, you know, wanting to shoot more just to get more experience. But, you know, I've put a good number of roles through at this point, and I feel confident on pretty much most things that I shoot that I could shoot it on film if I wanted to. Mm. So, yeah, it just kind of depends on what it is. But, you know, I'm always down. It's a challenge. You know, you don't really see what you're getting, you know, with digital. It's like, oh yeah, that's what it's going to look like. Awesome.
Yeah.
But you know, you get happy accidents, and I think it helps you focus a lot more, because it's just like, you can't really dig around and let it go or save your later. It's like, no, this is what it's going to be. So make sure that you like everything and you meter, you know, what you need. So I do like it for all those reasons, but, you know, I love digital. I love seeing what you get. And the challenge there for me is like, how do I make it look like a finished piece versus, you know, oh yeah, we'll fix that later. Or, oh, in the grade, you know, that'll totally tighten up. But I actually look at it on the day and say like, all right, like if this is what went out into the world, would I be happy with it?
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about Diva. I think we'll talk about this and then we'll go back to the beginnings of the John Carrington as we know him now. But I was going to say that I had a pretty big hand in the making of the film. But when I did see the cut of the film, my pretty big hand was taken out of the film.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot on the cutting room floor, which is totally cool. You know, I think, you know, there's shots that I wish were in there just because I like them, but, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not precious with those things. And Matthew never asked for my feedback on like what I thought should be in or shouldn't, and what's in, I feel like, is what needs to be in. So I'm super stoked on it. But, you know, we got a lot of stuff that, you know, hit the cutting room floor, which is great. It meant that we didn't not have enough, which is always the worry. You know, it's like, oh, we have too much good stuff. How do we fit it all in? And sometimes it just doesn't. That's good.
Yeah. For the listeners, when I said my big hand was in it, I have a small shot where I was kind of in the camera being the physical therapist because I was an extra hand. And my hand didn't make the cut. It wasn't pretty enough. But the rest of the film looks awesome. So you shot and colored this film, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
One thing I noticed while I was watching it is that, because I know you shot it on film, parts of it on film, parts of it on the Alexa Mini, and it seems like there's a bunch of different lenses used, and the aspect ratio changed multiple times. And then I also know that the film took a while to make because it started before COVID pandemic, and then it came back to it like a year later almost.
Yeah, year and a half.
Year and a half. Tell me more about the conversations that you and Matt had about, I don't know, the changing aspect ratio. I mean, it all looked good. I want to understand it a little better.
I mean, that's all Matthew. I mean, we talked about it because when we shot one scene, well, two scenes, but one night in December 2019 that I was in town shooting with Matthew on a different job. And we were like, well, I mean, since I'm in town, you kind of have this concept. Do we want to just have me stay an extra day or two and knock it out? And we're like, yeah. So we planned it out and we shot Lomo Anamorphics. And the idea was that we were going to, you know, shoot in December and then come back in like May or something, or even earlier, and finish it up. And obviously with COVID and stuff like that, that didn't happen. And it gave Matthew time to kind of like really look at the script and in the story and what he was wanting to accomplish. And he took that time and, you know, kind of went in a different direction than he originally had thought, you know, mindful that we already had some stuff in the can that we were going to use. And, you know, as we started talking, he was just kind of like, yeah, you know, I'm, I kind of want this to be a little more avant-garde, a little less linear. I kind of want to jump around like kind of different timelines to just kind of encompass more like thoughts than, you know, something that's like a linear narrative. And then, you know, he's been wanting to shoot film. We've talked about shooting film on some projects in the past, but never really pulled the trigger on it. And then I ended up buying a 35 millimeter. I bought a Arri 435 for perf. And, you know, we started talking. I was like, dude, we could do it on the 435. He's like, really? And I was like, yeah, I mean, we can totally do it. And he's like, okay. And so he kind of took that, you know, idea and made a few more tweaks. And then as we're kind of gearing up for it, I told him like, hey, the 435 is going to have a different aspect ratio. We can go on and shoot, you know, 240 and, you know, just crop the neg and everything, or, you know, we can change aspect ratios. And he kind of thought about it. I was like, man, I'm totally cool. It's just having each section kind of feel different and kind of be a different part of the timeline. So loosely in the film, when we're 4:3 or 2:35 or, you know, 16:9, those are different times in the narrative, yeah, even though we're jumping back and forth. So that's why you get those kind of different jumps. But, you know, that rule kind of breaks a few times. He ended up going 16:9 on film sometimes. He ended up going, I think that's the only thing, that he went 16:9 on film a few times when normally it would have been 4:3. But yeah, he just kind of embraced it and liked how it felt. And, you know, I remember he was getting through cuts. I was like, how are you feeling? He was like, it's exactly what I wanted. I said, oh, awesome.
Wow.
So, you know, it's just kind of what we decided. And we shot December 2019, we shot Anamorphic 239. And then in May 2021, we shot 185 film and we shot 185 digital, both spherical. For that, we shot the Black Wings, the Tribe 7 Black Wings. They have an interesting vibe. You know, they're newer lenses. They're kind of hard to get just because they are in demand and also not super prevalent. So we had a little bit of a tough time sourcing a set. You know, I just think we wanted something different. We didn't want to shoot really clean. We wanted it to feel a bit dirty. And I also wanted to shoot something that I could maybe trust a little bit more in terms of mechanics, knowing that we're shooting on film. I didn't want to shoot like a vintage set just because sometimes the mechanics of them can be kind of all over the place with like stiff focus and stuff. And I had heard that the Black Wings are pretty solid and I liked what I'd seen for them. So I just, in general, I wanted to shoot with them. So we were able to source a set from LA, from Boca Rentals, who were really awesome to help us out with that. And yeah, I mean, I thought they were awesome. I thought they're really great and the mechanics are really good, which let us kind of focus on the process of shooting film versus like troubleshooting lenses. Cause I remember the Lomo set that I used in 2019, like the 80 mil, the focus was so stiff that we really couldn't do pulls on it and stuff like that. And I just kind of thought about that. And the 35 was just super soft. It, you know, it's really hard to get a sharp image out of it. So like kind of thinking about those things going into the rest of the film, knowing that the stuff we had shot before, you know, was already in the can, we knew what we had. I just wanted something that was just maybe a little more reliable. So I kind of wanted to shy away from some of the vintage stuff.
Very cool. Well, another thing I noticed about this film was 2 days that we pretty much had all the toys to play with. You had the orbiters, you had the Titan tubes, you had a bunch of people. And then there was, or maybe, I guess it was 2 days. And then one day was just in the morning.
Yeah, yeah. We shot one night. And then the next day, me, Matthew, Brian French, my AC, and then you and Talent were just in a Airbnb, and that was it. You know, it's just really simple. And then we shot that next night. Yeah.
And then people were like walking in, they're trying to figure out why there were screaming going on.
Yeah.
The nosy neighbors.
Yeah. You know, usually when you're just hanging out and you hear screaming, you know, you probably want to check it out. So I appreciate the concern, but glad it was nothing but acting.
Yeah. It was kind of a contrast of like having all the toys to having a red curtain was basically
and a lamp.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just finding what was available and making that work. Do you enjoy those kind of constraints or do you like having all the toys all the time?
I think creativity is fostered through being put in a box, right? Yeah. You know, like if you have all the toys and you have all the things you need, like, yeah, you can do anything. And sometimes, you know, it's actually limiting on what you can do because to make a change is a process. You know, you got to talk to your gaffer, talk to his guys, get the Condor moved, you know, especially if the Condor's, you know, up in the sky and you need to fly something up like a gel or something. It takes time. So, you know, that's really fun. And I really enjoy that. And I like bigger setups and stuff like that. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, I like the small stuff too. Like, I shot a whole dock in Mongolia where we had Alexa Mini super speeds and we didn't bring any lighting at all. We did not have a light. I usually travel with a bunch of 6x rags just to have, just for any situation, but I don't even think we busted those out. And I'm super happy with how it looked. And, you know, it's just working with what nature gave us and where the sun was and trying to plan out times to shoot where it would be advantageous. That stuff's really fun for me. You know, I like both. It just depends on what it is. And as Matthew and I were talking, it's like, hey, you know, we got a lot to do in 2 days. And I don't know if I can really ask the guys to come out because it's going to be a long night anyway. It's like, cool, well, we'll just make it happen ourselves. I mean, you know, we should have everything we need to get an image, and it's really about the performance and what we're trying to do with the story. And, you know, as luck would happen, it looked pretty good too, I thought.
Yeah. I think it's some of my favorite stuff in the movie, especially maybe because I know how simple it was. Like, oh yeah, it was just a red curtain and a lamp.
Yeah.
And it looks like $1 million.
So. Yeah. Red curtain, lamp, and 200T film stock. That's all it was.
Well, speaking of big toys and doing things on the budget with no toys, tell us about your beginnings in filmmaking. Where did John Carrington start? John Carrington III.
Yeah, John Carrington III. well, there's a lot of Johns in my family. My great-grandfather, my grandfather, my dad, me, and my father-in-law are all Johns. That's a fun fact. So I came up through music. Music was what I did. I started playing guitar when I was like 12. And kind of a theme throughout life is if I'm really into something, I'm really good at teaching myself how to do it. But I got to be like really into it. As a student, I'm atrocious. I was such a bad student just because when I'm into something, like I'm really into that. And if I'm like kind of forced to do something, I have a tough time getting motivated.
Yeah.
I started college right out of high school, but I was playing in a band and I actually went to school. I was pre-law because just law in general and criminal justice system and stuff is really interesting to me. My grandmother was a lawyer. And after about a year, I was just like, yeah, I'm just really not digging this. I also was still in my hometown of Durant, Oklahoma, and I just really didn't enjoy it. And so I took a year off, and that's when I was a blackjack dealer for a while.
Oh yeah.
And I did that for about a year, and I was still doing some music, but I was also getting really into production, like producing and audio engineering. And one of my best friends from high school was up at the University of Central Missouri in Warrensburg, Missouri. And I had been up there a bunch to visit. And so I had friends, and it was a program that I was really interested in. So I ended up quitting my job as a blackjack dealer, thankfully, moving up to Warrensburg, Missouri. It sits outside Kansas City. And I was a music technology major, which is audio engineering. And it was a music major, and I taught myself how to play music, but I didn't know how to read music or anything. So it was actually really difficult for me because I had to learn how to read music. And I literally didn't know anything because I was just so self-taught. But I ended up doing okay for the most part. But what really changed for me is there was a church in town that my buddy had worked at, and they needed some help. And so I was kind of like the youth tech guy. And it was like a part-time job. It was like 10 hours a week, minimum wage. And then one day the youth pastor was like, hey, we're going to do this video. I don't even remember what it's about. And I just remember going like, oh yeah, that's cool. Like, who's going to do it? And he was like, well, you are. You're the tech guy. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. Like, I don't know anything about video. I love movies. Looking back, I mean, this is just to jump forward a bit. I've actually always wanted to be a filmmaker. The problem was I didn't think it was accessible for me. And so, you know, I thought you had to go to USC or UCLA or NYU, like all the big film schools and stuff like that. And so I always had it in my mind like, oh, that'd be really cool. But like, that's not going to happen. Like, you know, that's not something I can get into. I don't have access to it, especially coming from a small town in Oklahoma. Yeah. But so
it wasn't the hand you were dealt.
Yeah, exactly. And so I see the pun there. I'm going to acknowledge it, but I'm going to move forward from it. But no, it was good. It was good. Anyway, so we started doing more video stuff, and I kind of enjoyed it, and I was still a music major. And then I was working with the youth, and the main part of the church needed like more of like a dedicated video person for Bible study content and things like that. And so they hired me to start doing that stuff. And they actually invested a good bit of money into what they had. And this is probably like 2007. So it's like right when the 5D was like kind of coming out, the 7D. Yeah. I remember when I was working with the youth group, it was like a Canon GL2, you know, it's just DV tape. And then we had a Panasonic DVX-200B or DVX-100B and started shooting that. And that was the first camera I had that like could do 24 frames per second. And I thought it just looked amazing. And then, you know, 7D came out and I bought that and it just started doing more and more. And then I realized, like, as much as I loved producing music and being an engineer, like, I just could not give two shits about school at all. I just did not care. But I still had it in my mind that, like, I need to have a degree, right? So I went to my counselor and I was like, hey, what gets me out of here the fastest? And they're like, well, because of your year of being pre-law, you could get out with a political science degree here in like 2 semesters. And I was like, done. So I switched political science. But at this time, I was working full time at the church for like, I mean, it was a lot of money. It was like $20,000 a year. But it was a full-time job with benefits and, you know, that's for a broke college student. That's not too terrible. So I was doing that. And then my same buddy that I had kind of followed up there, he had already graduated and was living in St. Louis working for another church that was like a bit bigger. They had their media director quit. And so he was like, you should apply. And I was like, well, I'm not done with school. And he was like, I mean, do you really like school or would you rather just keep doing what you do? And I was like, well, I guess I'd rather just keep doing what I'm doing. So I ended up moving to St. Louis and I took a job at this other church, which was pretty decent size as far as churches go. And I wasn't like the video guy. I was like the media director. So I could kind of have a little bit more say in what I was doing and how we were doing things.
Yeah.
But I still didn't know anything at all. You know, I had a couple 70s, you know, is basically what I had. I was still having to do like Sundays, like volunteer stuff, like live video, lighting, like, even though like I wanted to be a filmmaker, I still had to do all this other kind of like video content and other duties, right? Right. And I was there for about a year and a half, but I got so burnt out. I was working like 80, 90 hours a week, like every single week. I only got one day off. I'd get Fridays off. We had service on Saturday nights. So Saturday night and Sunday morning, I had to be there and oversee things. And I just was getting pretty burnt out. And I had started to do a little bit of freelance work and, you know, kind of like meeting more people who did video. But I still was very much like on an island, just kind of teaching myself and trying new things.
Yeah.
And then in 2011, there's a church here in South Carolina called New Spring. It's a very large mega church. And I had known them and I had kind of become buds with some people on staff. And they reached out and said, hey, would you be interested in coming and working here? You know, we like your work that you've done. We'd love to see if maybe you're a good fit here. And that same week, I got a call or an email, I think from Jared Hogan, who was at Elevation at the time, which is in Charlotte. And I was like, kind of the same thing. Like, hey, you know, would you maybe be interested in coming here? And so I was like, oh, okay. So I got two churches, which is the only industry I had known at the time in the same area. Like maybe that's what I should do, right? Maybe I should look into it. And so I ended up going to New Spring and I worked there for 4 years. And that's where I really got a chance to kind of cut my teeth a bit more and learn because they had budget, right? I now had access to a Red. I now had access to lighting and I had some stuff before, but I had just very, very little hands. I mean, it's the first time I really got to work with other people to where like I didn't have to do everything. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And during that time in the church, we grew a lot. I think when I joined, I think we were running like 15, 16,000 people a weekend. I mean, which is massive. But when I left, it was like 40. Like, yeah, it was huge. And we had a big budget. And, you know, we got a chance to travel places. Like I started shooting in Israel a lot. with the church and things like that. And I had actually, before that, I'd been doing a lot of like free nonprofit international work, because somebody would be like, hey, like, we hear that you like to travel, and so we'll pay your way to China and pay for you to be there for 2 weeks to shoot for us. And I'd be like, yeah, sounds good. Like, I didn't get paid anything, but it didn't cost me anything. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so I did a lot of trips like that. And so I've done a lot of international work even before I went to New Spring. And then I kind of picked up from there a little bit. But yeah, I was there for 4 years, and I really got a chance to work with more people. And I got a chance to, because, you know, people would see us, and we did pretty good work, especially for church world. Then people outside of church world are like loosely affiliated would ask me to start working on their stuff. So I started doing more freelance work and stuff. And then in 2015 is when I left. In 2015, it just was time for me to go. I mean, they were really good to me, but I just felt like that's not where I needed to be anymore. But it also kind of came up pretty quick in terms of like they were kind of asking me to be something that I wasn't, and I didn't really enjoy being there anymore. I felt like it wasn't very creative, and I wasn't like learning anything. So like 1 week I have a job, and the next week they're like, you know, do you really want to be here? I'm like, no, not really. And so I left, and I had like $300 in my bank account, no computer, no camera. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to try freelance. That's what I'm going to do.
And just so jumped right in.
Yeah. I just literally jumped, but New Spring was really good to me. They helped me out a little bit, in that kind of transition period, which I'm really appreciative of. And then it just started hitting the ground running. And luckily I had been doing a bit of color work for different people, and for whatever reason, my name started getting out a little bit more. So I really wasn't getting a chance to DP as much as I wanted, because I got into color because I wanted my stuff to look better.
Right.
So I don't consider myself a colorist, but I can do it, and I've graded lots of things, and it's good, but like I want to DP, and that's who I am. So I just started coloring a bit, which, you know, helped a lot. And, you know, I was able to start making some money, and then I would just kind of hustle on the DP side. Lots of free projects, lots of music videos, lots of stuff that I really couldn't charge a lot for, but it was an opportunity to start build my name.
Right.
Yeah, just kind of built it from there. That's kind of what it's been. And then the last probably 3 years, I just stopped talking about color work altogether. I'd still on my website, but like when I share on Instagram or when I, you know, talk about myself, like it's a DP, and I still do a good bit of color work, and I still enjoy it. And the thing that it's really afforded me are relationships, because a lot of people that I shoot with now, I started out doing color work for them, and then I built a relationship, and we started talking, and they liked my work, and we were able to kind of build into where I'm, you know, being a DP for them now. Like Matthew Rojas is one of those people. Like I did like 2 or 3 color jobs, and then he kind of brought me on as a DP, and that's kind of, you know, how it grew. And we've done a number of stuff together since then. So
being a colorist kind of got your foot in the door,
yeah,
to doing the DP stuff that you actually love to do.
Well, I mean, it got my foot in the door in terms of being able to talk to and have access to people, right? Because there's people that, I mean, just with the work that I had at the time, I just didn't have anything that could show what I could do. Right. I had some music videos, some international stuff, like it was fine, but I don't think it's anything that really reflected the type of work that I know I'm capable of. And I had done color work that did. I'd done color work with people and on projects that was at a higher level than what I was able to show as a DP. Right. And then the relationship comes in where you start talking to people, you start talking about how you like to work, what your thoughts are, who you are as a person. And that transitions into, well, maybe I'll have John shoot this. Like that might be cool. And my big thing is I always want to be the right guy for the job. I don't want to be a guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't get really precious with directors when they're like, you know, I have a couple people who are just too nice, and they're just like, oh yeah, I kind of was thinking about you for this one, but I really want to work with this other guy. Is that cool? And like, they kind of feel bad. And it's like, no, dude, like use whoever you want. Like, you know, I want everyone to be doing well, and I want to see other people succeed and get opportunities. And if I'm the right guy for the job, I definitely want it. But if it's just not the right thing, then like, that's totally cool.
Yeah, I understand that completely. You want to be the right person for the job, because if you're not, then the job may not be right for you.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, I say no to so much stuff. And a lot of times nowadays it's schedule, right? It's I wish I had 9 days a week, 48 hours a day. You know, like I really got to be careful about like overextending myself and saying yes to everything and not being able to put everything I have into a project because I'm so like just tired or like I'm thinking about this other job that I'm doing. You know what I mean? But, you know, at the same time, it's like I do say no to things that I'm just like, yeah, I don't know if that's for me, you know, and it's great people, great director, great creative. It's just I just turned down a feature because it just wasn't the right situation for me. I think I would have done really well with the content, but I just couldn't get around some of the other stuff that how they wanted to do things. And I just was like, yeah, you know, I want to do features and it's been a couple of years since I've done one and I really enjoy them, but I don't think this is the right one, even though the budget was like more than three times the largest budget feature I'd done before, you know? Wow.
Kudos to you for like sticking with your guns and like not succumbing to something that is, I don't know the right way to phrase it, but like, you know, it's an attractive thing,
you know, it's something that you're like, I mean, in another year, in another situation, I would kill for this one, but it's just not the right thing right now, especially, you know, having to be gone for 7 weeks, kind of not short notice, but shorter than I'd like, and having to say no to other relationships and things that I've built over the years that I'm excited about.
Yeah. We talked a little bit before we started rolling on the show that you're just blowing up with work. Like you're booked for 17 days next month and you were booked most of last month as well. Where would you attribute most of this work coming from? Is it from people you met at the church way back in the day? Is it through the advice everyone gives, like just going out for coffee with people? And
well, I'm actually terrible at the going out for coffee with people. Like I'm a really bad networker. I've never sent an email like saying, hey, my name's John, I'm a DP, I really like your work, I'd like to work with you someday. Like I've never done that. And now I think it's super valuable and I should do that. I'm not knocking anybody that's super good at that. In fact, the people that are really good at that are way ahead of me in terms of their careers, I'm sure. Right. But for me, for whatever reason, I have all the excuses of why I haven't and don't do that. But I mean, I just attribute it to doing good work and being a good hang and being somebody that I like to think at least reflects that they really care about what they do. Right. Mm-hmm. So like in the last 6 weeks, I've worked with three directors that I've wanted to work with for a long time. Hmm. Who I've maybe done color work for in the past, and we've tried to make things work. Like I just finished a spot in Phoenix with Matthew Underwood, and Matthew and I have done probably 7 or 8 color jobs together. Like he's directed and brought to me, and I've done color for it. And we've tried to work together. I can't tell you how many times over the past 2-3 years, but schedules would change or jobs would go away or it's just whatever. And it's just never worked out. And we finally got one and we did it and it was awesome. It was super, super fun, but it was also exactly what we knew it was going to be because we had that relationship. We had worked together on the color side. We've spent hours on the phone. We were friends, you know, and then an opportunity comes out for me to come and shoot it. And I feel like I did a really good job and he was really happy and everything went super smooth and it's going to lead to us working together again, you know? And so that's kind of what I attribute. I just attribute it to doing good work and being somebody who's very personable and really cares about the project and will, you know, put a lot into it to make it the best it can be.
Yeah. Well, I could see that from being able to see you work with Matthew. I could tell that this guy's putting his whole heart and soul into making this thing look awesome, whether it's bringing your own film camera and I don't know, like what you did for this podcast, going above and beyond to add the compressor, get the microphone out of the drawer. That kind of stuff is appreciated.
Yeah.
I know that you have to invest in people to progress in your film career, and that's kind of what you've been talking about, is being personable, being a good hang. What are some of the best investments you think that you have made in your filmmaking career? Now, this can be knowledge, this can be, like I said, people or actual gear. Like, what would you say are some of your best investments? This is kind of a strange question because it can go anywhere.
No, it's a good question. you know, from a financial standpoint, there's two. One, my Alexa Mini was a really great investment because it allowed me to do a lot of jobs that paid zero money, but I was able to make it look really great. Now, I could have done it on lesser cameras and it still would have looked good, but having that really inspires me, right? You know, it's not like I'm looking at someone just like, you know, I wish we had the money to be able to do it this way. You know, it's like I can make the call on different projects to bring it on if money's not there and really set the production up to do the best possible. And I'm pretty camera agnostic. You know, I've shot Red twice in the last month because that's what they wanted to use. And I got a job coming up on the Venice. You know, anytime we don't go with the Alexa, like I'm not hurt about that at all. But just for me being able to have a camera and say, hey, you, me, talent, let's go shoot it. You know, that type of thing has been a really good investment, not just financially, but like just creatively. It's like I shoot a lot of stills and I'm a big Leica guy. And Leicas are expensive and you could easily say that the spec wise, they're not as good as some other things out there, but they're inspiring. Like when I'm holding a Leica, I feel like taking a photo, I feel like I'm seeing things a different way. And I feel the same way about the Alexa. Mm-hmm. And then, the, you know, the other thing is, and this is an maybe a different kind of answer for this, is jobs that I'm not necessarily passionate about in terms of what they are. Like I'm thinking like talking heads and things like that. Yeah. But I do them for two reasons. One, they give me money, which is important. So I can do the things that I want to do. So that I can spend money and time on a short film in Dallas with Matthew Rojas. So I can spend money on G&E and lenses for a music video I did with my buddy Dylan Hahn. Like I can invest in projects because I'm making money on things that maybe I'm not going to show. Like I'm just not going to show it. And it's not that it's a bad project or the director sucks or anything. It's just, yeah, this isn't really what I want to be doing day in, day out. So I'm going to be really specific about what I show, but this job pays me money that I can turn into something. Like I got my first union national commercial for Domino's because I paid like, I think $6,000 to make a music video happen like three weeks before or like a month before. And the producer that was on that showed my work to another producer that was producing this Domino's job and they brought me on. You know what I mean? Like I've invested in these personal projects and these things that I really, really care about. And it's brought me work that is of a higher caliber, you know? And I think a lot of it's just giving a shit about what you do. It's like, I care about this, so I'm going to invest in it. And even if I don't care about something, like I'm still going to approach it like it's super important, like a job that I know I'm not going to show, right? I'm still going to do the work to the highest level I can because I just cannot not care about something. I know I'm not going to show it. I know all this is going to do is bring me, you know, a little bit of financial stability and maybe a relationship with somebody that maybe the next one's better or they want to bring me on more of these things. And that's cool because it's money and they're happy and I'm happy and it's mutually beneficial. But regardless, I'm going to do everything I can to make it great. And I'm going to really, really care about it.
I think that's great advice. JP Summers kind of gave me similar advice one time. I sent him a message. I guess he's not a message guy, but he ended up calling me afterwards. It's like, because I was asking him, should I take this job that is definitely outside of my comfort zone?
Yes, you always take the job that's outside your comfort zone. No, 100%. If I ever have that question, it's a yes. Like if you think it's too big for you or something, it's like, well, this is an opportunity that's presented and I may feel like I'm in over my head, but I'm ready for it because it's been presented to me. At least that's my mindset.
And it ended up being a good and bad experience because there were some red flags going into the project. Like the director called me going into it and said, hey, do you have a boomstick? A boomstick? Anyway, so when you say boomstick, run. But those two clips that we end up shooting because the rest of the project fell through because the actress didn't show up, those are on my reel.
Yeah. I remember you telling me about that. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and, you know, I think about things. I just shot this car commercial And I've done some car stuff, but this is for like a big brand. And it was like, we're going to have a Russian arm. And the director knew a lot of, like, has done a lot of car work, you know? And so I'm looking here, like, I'm a little bit intimidated because it's like this director who also is a very good DP in his own right, has done a lot of car stuff. It's for a big brand. I've done some car stuff. It's my first time on a Russian arm. I've done like the motor crane. So I've done like motor crane, but I've never done like a full on Russian arm and all this stuff. And, you know, so I was intimidated, and I was like, there's a part of me that was like, I don't know if I can do this like, well, right. But that was just a fleeting thought. And I just said, suck it up. You're going to be fine. You're going to have the people around you to help you out. You're going to be able to communicate well. You know what you like aesthetically, like just go for it. Like, don't even worry that it's not going to go well. And it went super well, you know, but I was, you know, it was a little scary for a second, just because it was something that felt bigger than I had done before. But those are the times when you just really want to say, yeah, I need to do this. Like, this is going to be a good thing.
That's cool. Well, if it's anything like your stuff that you've shot for Loki's Body Shop, then I think it's going to be awesome, because we've talked about that, those ads multiple time on the show with Wilson and Matthew. Those are just so cool. The best body shop ads I've ever seen, ever.
That was the goal. Yeah, those are fun. Those are really good. And the guys at Loki are just super nice. They let us kind of do what we want. Even though the budgets aren't like fantastic, it's just like, they're really good dudes. You want to help them out and they just let you play, which is like kind of, especially on projects like that, that's what you want, you know? Like, I think they weren't even there when we were shooting the car stuff. Like, they were just like, all right, you guys have fun. We're like, all right, bye.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Now, I know that you don't like advertise that you're a colorist, and you don't like talking about being a colorist, but I do have some questions about being a colorist.
And it's not that I'm not proud to be a colorist. It's just, that's not how I think of myself. And I know I can do the job and I can do it well. And I do it all the time still. It's just a perception thing, because I knew I was doing something right when people would be like, hey man, I don't know if you're still color or not, and that's what I want. I just don't want to be known as strictly a colorist. I'm totally fine if someone's like, oh, he's a DP and a colorist, but as long as DP's first and that's the majority of the work that I'm getting, that's where I want to be. You know what I mean? Like, if I was not wanting to be a colorist, I would not do color work, but I want to, because it's fun. And it's also really insightful to see how other people shoot and how they do things. And you kind of look behind the curtain and see what the intentions are and how things turn out. And, you know, there's so many benefits to being a colorist that I glean from other people. Right. But at the end of the day, it's just not what I want to do 24/7.
Right.
You know what I mean? I want to be out and I want to be on set and I want to work with people and I want to be the DP. Like, that's it. But it's not that I don't like talking about it. It's not that I don't want to do it. Very much the opposite. I love talking color. I love doing color for people. I'm just very aware that people will pigeonhole you as one thing. And so I want to lead with DP, but I will absolutely do color. And I, you know, also it's not the worst thing in the world when you get to double dip on a project, when you DP it and then they ask you to do color and you have a lot of control and you get to really do what you want to do with it. And you also get paid twice, which is really nice.
Yeah. I hear that's not a luxury a lot of DPs have. They don't have like any say in the color. So,
oh yeah.
It seems like you get so much more control over what you shot.
Oh yeah. All the like, you know, bigger spots that I've done, it's, they say, here's the spot. And I didn't even know they were doing color. I mean, very rarely have I ever gotten to, you know, have much of a say in it. But you know, this job I just did with Matthew, they kind of said, do you want to do color on it? And I was like, well, where were you thinking about going? They're like, well, we were going to go to company 3. And I was like, go to company 3, do it. Cause they're phenomenal. Every single one of the people that are on there do such a great job. And at the end of the day, like that's my next kind of relationships I want to build. I want to build relationships with colorists and let them make me look good, just like I have tried to make other people look good. You know what I mean? The more people you're able to work with and communicate and show that level you're working, I think that's a positive thing. So I've, you know, worked with a couple people at company 3, and Asa Fox has done some work for me. Mm-hmm. He's phenomenal. Like, I want to build those relationships too, but I also am aware that like, if I'm going to bring, I don't want to ask favors from them unless it's like something that I really, really believe in. Right. I'd rather the jobs kind of go to them and do that, because I do know I can do it myself. And I also, if it's a freebie, like, I'll just do it because I get the control. Yeah. But I'm also like respecting their craft and what they're doing and making sure that like they're taken care of.
So what leads up to saying I am a colorist? Because I know you do a lot of self-teaching and self-study. Like, at what point do you feel comfortable saying I can charge people money to color things the way I do? Because I can mess with the wheels in Premiere, the Lumetri stuff. I can make things look okay, but I know I don't have the secret sauce that I wouldn't label myself a colorist. But when do you break the threshold from guy who messes with the wheels every once in a while to doing paid projects?
I think it's how you work with people. It very much has to do with the creative and like how, what your aesthetic is and how you do it and everything. But I think it's how you're able to communicate with somebody, to have conversations on what they want and be able to execute that. Right. So it's one thing to be able to, and matching, honestly, matching is the hardest part, because it's one thing to say, hey, I have the shot and I can make this one shot look good. Like, that's relatively easy.
Yeah.
It's really hard to take a 4-minute thing and make it all match and feel like the same piece and aesthetically be in the same world, you know, or even to shot to shot matching, you know, with how things can be on the day, and the control you do or don't have. But really it's about, hey, am I able to have a conversation with somebody, hear what they want, and then execute that. And on top of that, make it even better than they thought. Right. So it's not a practical thing of like, oh, once you learn how to do qualifiers, you're a colorist. It's more of like, you know, filmmaking is a team sport where you're having to work with other people and other opinions and other aesthetics. And how do you work into those worlds to where you can give them what they want while still being able to put your stamp on it? You know what I mean? And you know, sometimes people come to me and they say, I just like your style. That's what I want. It's like, cool, I'll give you what I want, but you may not like it, because as much as you like my style, you still have yours. And my red and your red are different reds. Like, it's really hard to communicate color into absolute terms, right? My dark is not your dark. So, you know, how do you keep a project going? How do you stay on time? How do you stay within budget and make everybody happy? That's when you know you're a colorist, right? I got really like, so one of my best friends, and I love him dearly. He's one of the best people I know, Cale Glendening. We're both from Oklahoma. We didn't know each other when we were in Oklahoma, but we became friends like a decade ago. I mean, longer. Yeah. At least 10 years ago. And he was in Tulsa shooting a short film, and he had put out on Twitter something like that, like, hey, does anyone want to come hang? Could use some help. And I was up in Kansas City at the time. I was like, yeah, I'll come down. It's like a 5-hour drive, but my mom lives in Tulsa. I can just stay with her. Like, well, anyway, we became friends in that project. I ended up coloring for him because the guy that was going to do it had to drop out. And I've worked with Cale. I mean, we've done 20, 30 projects over the last decade or something like that. I mean, just tons of stuff. And he's also one of the best people I know. And he was like my first like film friend. You know what I mean? And so like me getting into color and the work that I've done with Cale is what has really pushed a lot of that. And, you know, I'm really grateful that he saw something in me that was like, no, no, man. I mean, I remember telling him, I don't know if I can do this because I've never done anything like this. He's like, you'll be fine. You'll be great. Like, I know you can do this. And so, you know, that's kind of how it goes. You start doing something for one person, you build that, and then you learn over time how to do that for other people. And, you know, how to kind of work those relationships. And, you know, that's kind of how I got into color. I just kind of started doing it, but I'm very aware of like what I'm good at, what I'm not. Like if somebody came to me with like a Pantene beauty thing, I may not be the best guy for that. Like I just don't do really great beauty work. I can do some, like if it's, you know, like, oh, we just need this person to look better, I can do that. But if it's like, no, this is like a makeup beauty thing, I'm like, I don't know, man. Not in my wheelhouse.
That's awesome. I never really thought of, maybe this is just telling you how ignorant I am. I never really thought of the colorist as the team player. I thought it was the guy behind the computer that makes things look pretty. So thank you for opening my eyes to understanding what.
But you never, I mean, very rarely it's I get something, I do it, I turn and say, here you go. right? There's notes, and those notes could vary wildly. So it's really good to have combos ahead of time, have references, try to be on the same page with things, and try to get as close as possible on the first one, and then kind of go from there. You know, you just, like I said, you're never on an island. You never just get to do whatever you want. You have to work with other people's aesthetics and opinions and things like that. Otherwise you're just not going to be successful, in my opinion. I know there's some guys that can do everything themselves top to bottom, and that is impressive and great. But if you look at everyone that you probably look up to and is successful, I guarantee you're just really great with people and really great at communicating ideas and really great at being on the same page aesthetically with people. And not just being on the same page, but taking something and elevating it. That's something like I never want to direct. Directing is not something I'm interested in because I'm not an idea guy, right? I'm not somebody that can kind of come up with an idea out of nowhere and like put it to paper and pitch it and get it, right? But when you tell me an idea, I can think of so many ways to make it better or different or add to it. Like I feel like I'm somebody that comes into an already established idea and makes it better or makes it more streamlined or, you know, gives a perspective that is beneficial to the production and what we're trying to do. Like, that's what my strength is.
Yeah, I could see that. You were the polisher of the ideas. Oh, well, I've been having a lot of aha moments of things that I personally need to do while you've been talking today. What are some aha moments that you've had recently that you feel like have taken you to the next level or just like, I don't know, just a new way of thinking about things that have helped you out?
I think one thing that was really cool recently, it was on that job I did with Matthew Underwood. Right before the first day, as we're loading in, he goes, "Hey man, there's this video I want you to watch before we start. It's just, I saw it this morning. It put me in a good headspace. And I think it'd be really good for you to kind of be in that same zone with me." And I said, "Okay, cool, man." You know, so he sent it to me as we were loading in and kind of getting ready for the first setup before I really gave like instruction on what we're going to do to the crew. So I just went off to the side and I watched it, and man, it totally put me in the right headspace. Like it totally inspired me to get after it that day. And it, the video wasn't what we were going for, right? It's not like, hey, we want to do this, so look at this before we do it. It was just the emotional content of the ad, I think, was in line with what we were trying to do. And the score was beautiful and the story was beautiful. And I don't know, I really enjoyed that. And that was something that I really appreciated. And I hadn't really had anyone do that for me before in terms of like, you know, it's just kind of like setting that tone right at the start. And I just went up to him and said, "Man, dude, that was awesome. Like I'm totally ready for the day. I'm invigorated. I'm not nervous. Like, you know, I feel good." And he's like, "Okay, yeah, it felt the same for me." So I think that's something that I want to try to do a little bit more, even for myself, because not every director is going to do that. You know what I mean? And so how can I integrate that into my workflow in terms of, you know, being in that right headspace from the get-go and start and really feeling like getting after that instead of like maybe being nervous or kind of thinking about things that aren't as important, you know, like being worried about this one setup, because when we get there, we're going to be pinched for time and then we got to go to this next thing. And so how do I make sure that I'm thinking ahead and keeping everything smooth? It's like you get in that right headspace, you don't worry about those things anymore and you're just focused on the task at hand. So I thought that was really cool.
That's awesome. I've heard about directors playing certain music when they want their actors to feel a certain way. I never thought about that for the crew, but that seems like it would be just as powerful. So I'm kind of jumping around here.
All good.
But I think one of the first videos that I saw where I've noticed your name and I was like, holy crap, this is the good stuff, is your music video you did for Roland Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
Wait.
Yep.
I remember watching that. I was like, this is perfect. This is perfectly done. I need to talk to this guy. And then ever since I saw your name, I started seeing it everywhere. And like, oh, he did the color for this. He DP'd this. Oh, he's in this Film Riot episode about color correction that I know I've seen before, but I didn't realize who it was. So could you tell me a little bit more about that music video? It was directed by Dylan Hahn. I've been seeing his name a lot more. Tell us more about that project. Where did it start?
Yeah, so Dylan is awesome. I met Dylan. He worked at a home financing firm, like doing video content. Him and his buddy TJ Morrison and his fiance Elizabeth Coggins, who are all kind of doing the thing now. They're all really great. And so he, him and TJ were literally the G&E crew for my last feature that I did. It was super small. It was really just them and like some students to help like carry stuff around. And Dylan, you know, had hired me for color work in the past, and I developed a good relationship with him, and actually had him on my crew for a few things. I think I took him to Haiti one time for a doc thing that he was my AC for.
Oh, wow.
But we're at the end of this feature, and he goes, "Hey, man, I have this music video I really want to do. I really want to get into directing, and I have this music video I want to do, and I really like for you to shoot it." And I was like, "Cool, yeah, man, I'm totally down." And like, I think highly of Dylan, but you know, anytime someone comes up to me, it's like, "I want to direct," you don't know how that's going to be, right? Like, I was super down. Right. I knew he'd be fine, but it's like, is he going to be a good director, or is this just going to be like a thing I do, you know, to help my buddy out?
Yeah.
You know, and he told me the concept and everything. I was like, man, this is pretty good. And then funny enough, I actually knew Roland from like 6 years ago. I think when I was at the church, we tried to hire him randomly. so I was familiar with him.
It's from, Roland. It's not.
I don't know. I've heard everyone say it different. Dylan's known him longer and says Roland. So I'm going to go with that.
Okay.
But
I just want to make sure I say it right.
I'm sure he gets it all the time, and he's the nicest guy in the world. So, you know, Roland, we love you. Don't worry that we don't know your actual name. So anyway, he tells me the concept. I'm like, okay, this is cool. Like, but there's a lot of weird, you know, like water everywhere. And I'm like, does he understand logistically how hard this is going to be? But he really fought for it. And he had guys in place to do it. And they did tests. And I was just like, all right, like, we'll just do it. And so I think we shot 3 days. We might have shot 2 days. It was a while ago. And it was awesome. It was just super fun. And the concept is all Dylan. And he did a really, really good job. And, you know, there's a couple things, you know, we're super good friends, so I can say things like this. Like, there's a few things just from a logistics standpoint. Like, he wanted to do two takes every time. He was like, one at 24, one at 48, one at two. And I was like, man, we are going to run out of time. You need to like decide, are we shooting 48 or are we shooting 24? And I remember that it's like the one time I was like, you're doing too many takes. And, you know, like, he's the director. Most people, you know, I'll suggest things, but I basically told him, you got to make a decision on this because we're gonna fall behind on the schedule really fast. And so we ended up.
Yeah, just that's part of your job, though.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think I was able to get to that point faster. A lot of times with directors, like, you definitely want to respect the position, and you want to suggest things and like kind of explain your position and what you're going for without like telling them what to do. Right. Like, yeah, you want them to make the decision. And I feel very strongly about that. Like, you know, I don't ever want to go in and be like, no, we're doing it this way. Like, not at all what I ever want. But with Dylan, I was like, dude, we're going to do it this way. Like, it's like the one time I'll do that. Yeah, I mean, he just did a great job with it. He really allowed me to play a lot. Like, there's a lot of scenes in that video that weren't scripted or storyboarded. Like, the whole scene of them kind of hugging back in the sun with all the particles flying by and stuff like that. Like, that was on the day. Like, I saw this thing and saw that floating in the wind. I was like, hey, since we're waiting on this other setup, can I borrow Maddie and Roland and we go over here and we can have a bunch of people just shaking these things on the side? And, you know, that whole thing was just improv, was just like on the day, like, this looks awesome, let's do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we had a couple scenes that were like that. And then we had the scenes that were very specifically, you know, kind of planned out. But yeah, we just kind of went for it.
What was your camera and lighting package like? Did you have a lot to play with, or was this one of the red curtain type shoots?
We had a decent bit. We had my Alexa Mini, my set of Tokina Vista Primes, which people ask me about what lenses we shot on that pretty often. They were just Tokina Vista Primes, but I had the whole time a Schneider TrueNet 1 filter in, which is really stylized. And I think that's kind of what throws people off. That it looks like something that might be a little more like vintage. Yeah. And then lighting wise, a guy named Heath Franklin was my gaffer. We had his truck and it had a good amount of stuff on there. It had a couple HMIs, some LED type stuff. I think we had a few light panels, Geminis. It wasn't crazy. The biggest setup was probably the diner.
Oh, yeah.
And we had an HMI outside, aperture 300D, Gemini into the ceiling, and then a light mat through the window when we were doing the close-ups. And I think we changed all the light bulbs, but that's it. So we kept it pretty streamlined. We didn't have a big crew. You know, we only had probably three on G&E, I think. So there wasn't a ton to do. And then the bathtub scene, the bathtub was on the second floor, but there was a roof right outside. So we had to like get a ladder, get up there, get the HMI through the window. But that's all there was on that scene. Just one HMI and a bunch of black to neg it out. And I remember one HMI flickered really bad at 48 frames per second. So we had to switch it out for the other one, or at least the ballast. But yeah, it was pretty, none of the setups were massive. They were pretty simple for the most part. Every project is a sum of all its parts. It's everybody working together for something. Yes, you have some people who are in more creative leadership positions, like the director, the DP, who are really setting the tone for things. But like the guys are doing the work. So like, I mean, I don't do a lot. You know, I communicate and I try my best to set people up, not just for the setup we're working on, but further down the line so that, you know, we always know what we're going to next. We're really efficient because I'm also very time aware, where, you know, overtime's a thing. And if you're not quick and you don't know what you want, like you're going to fall behind. And I don't want that to be camera's fault. If the client wants to take forever, cool. Director wants to take forever, cool. But we're not waiting on camera. Yeah. When I say it's going to be 20, 30 minutes, like it's going to be 20, 30 minutes. And if something comes up, I will communicate immediately what the time's going to be. But, you know, my goal is to make the day and make it great and also, you know, do really good work.
I really want to thank you for being on the show today. I had so many personal aha moments, like I already said, and I just love your stuff. Thanks, everything you touch looks great.
We didn't even talk about that. I live in Greenville.
Oh, yeah. So why Greenville?
Greenville's awesome. I mean, Greenville's a really great town. My wife and I really like it here. It's inexpensive. The downside is I just don't really work here often, maybe a couple times a year and almost always from out of town. I do co-own a production company, but even that work is not really here a lot. But it's inexpensive. We really love the area. It's a growing city, but it's also really easy to get to other places like, you know, planes are not too expensive. And I really haven't, I'm sure that if I lived in LA and New York, there'd be certain opportunities that I would have that I wouldn't have here sooner. But I think eventually I will have those opportunities. You know, there's guys that have done a really good job of not living in LA, New York, or any other kind of big production hub and doing really well for themselves. I mean, one guy I think of is Paul Myers. I think he's in Salt Lake, he's in Utah, and he's just always crushing it. Like, he's just so good. And, you know, I kind of look at that and say, like, personally, I'd love to live in New York. I love New York a whole lot, but, you know, there's a certain standard of living that we have here that's really nice, and it's kind of slow. And when I'm home, I get to kind of be home.
Right.
You know, versus kind of always hustle and bustle. But, you know, it's one of those things that I don't know in the future what's going to happen or what we're going to want to do. I mean, my wife is a huge part of that. And, you know, we have family in D.C. And so we've talked about, you know, maybe we go to the D.C. area. But even then, I talk to my friends that live in D.C. and they're like, you're going to be traveling. I mean, it's just we're kind of used to me being gone. And that's decisions that we have to make together. And she's really, really great about it as long as I communicate well. You know, sometimes I kind of forget certain things and that's not good, but that's on me. But she's super supportive. And as long as she'll, you know, be cool with me going, you know, we can kind of do whatever we want. And I think that's a really nice goal to have, is just kind of do what you want when you want. And living in a big city is a lot more expensive. And so we probably would have to kind of sacrifice our time a little bit more for jobs, but I luckily don't have to do that. I can kind of just do the jobs I want to and let the other ones pass and, you know, continue to build relationships. And no one seems to have a problem with me being in Greenville. So I'll, you know, just stay here for now.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. And it's close to Charlotte. It's close to Charleston. It's close to Atlanta. It's close to Knoxville. It's close to Nashville. I can get on a plane to any place in a day, you know.
Yeah.
Like, it's really not that logistically difficult. And luckily, you know, I don't think anyone in Greenville knows that I'm here. Like, there's people here, but there's not a lot. Like, I know I just shot a hospital ad for a pretty big agency that's here. And they're like, so where are you out of? And I was like, oh, I'm out of Greenville. They're like, oh, we're out of Greenville. I'm like, yeah, I know. Like, oh, we didn't know you were in town. I was like, yeah, I am, you know, if you want.
Small world.
Yeah. You know, and so it's one of those things where it's just like, you know, that's kind of funny.
That's cool that you're wanted by your talent, not just by you're the guy who's local.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've turned down so much local stuff that I'm just like, yeah, I'm not interested in that. Because, you know, when you're in a smaller town or a smaller production, they don't really understand rates. You know, yeah. Like, I'm sure I get a bunch of for being expensive, but I'm really not that expensive. It's just you don't value my time. You know, you don't value what I'm bringing to a project. So why would I want to do it? You know, because respect goes both ways. Like, I respect your project and what you're doing, but you also need to respect, you know, what I'm bringing in and stuff like that. And sometimes that's not money, but a lot of times it is when someone's just like, you know, I had this one guy ask me where I ate and I told him, and he was just like, oh, so you must think you're really good. And I was like, okay, dude, like, that's not really the right way to start this conversation. And I was like, I think that what I bring to the project is valuable. And if you don't agree, then maybe we're not going to work very well together. You know?
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
How bold. That's fine. You must think you're really good.
Yeah, it was kind of but, you know, at the same time, it's like,
gosh.
You know, I only want to work with good people. I want to work with people who are homies and who respect me and my opinions and what I bring to the project. And I'm going to give that right back tenfold. You know, that's what's more important to me. You know, so if I kind of get a vibe that I'm just a guy that's pushing stuff and how dare me for having a certain rate or whatever, it's just like, man, I'd rather just not work with you. You know, good luck. And I hope, you know, your project's successful, but it's not something I'm interested in at the moment.
Well, that guy was saying, you think you must be really good. Well, I think you're really good. So whatever your rate is, you deserve it.
I appreciate it. Maybe I'm not very good, and that's okay too. But, you know, I really enjoy the people I get to work with, and there's a lot more that I hope to work with in the future. And so I'm just going to keep doing what I'm going to do, and it's just trying to do better every time. And so far, it's been pretty good for me.
Well, thanks again for taking the time to talk with me today. And I really appreciate all that you do, all that you've said. It's personally helped me a lot. And so what's the best way people can connect with you and find your stuff?
Probably Instagram. At jcarrington3. I'm on there a decent bit, and people tend to like to reach out there a lot, so that's a good one. Also my website, johncarrington.co. I keep up with the cinematography side pretty good. The color side is needs some TLC, but hopefully I have a new site coming here in a little bit. I'm also really terrible at reels. I've only cut one reel, and that was, I think, released January 2016. So it's been a minute. So I'm working on a couple new ones that hopefully are out, and hopefully, you know, that's a better representation of where I'm at currently in the career and what I'm trying to do. But, yeah, I mean, the big thing is like, just, love chatting, love helping people out. Love, you know, anyone ever wants to chat, like, just hit me up. We'll party.
All right. Take that invitation. Go party.
That's it. Thanks for listening. I hope this episode helps you do great work, be the artist you want to be, and helps you to not be afraid to jump in with both feet and make things happen in your film community. Be sure to follow John on his Instagram and website. Feel free to send him a DM and show him some love, because he definitely deserves it. I'll leave a bunch of links in the show notes so you can find his amazing work. And once again, be sure to check out Diva, because it's dropping on September 27th, 2021! Also, I had Slim Shady record something for you.
Thanks for listening to Hometown Hollywood. Leave a review on iTunes, that'd be good.
And that definitely wasn't AI. Thanks to all you home dogs for listening and sharing. Be sure to stay tuned for our next awesome guest on the Hometown Hollywood podcast.
Yeah, blackjack dealer is pretty random. Not a lot of people are like, oh yeah, I used to deal blackjack for a living. You know, it's just something I did, you know. It's kind of up there with like prostitution, so.
Almost.
One of my goals is to go home to where I used to deal blackjack and shoot a commercial for him. So that'd be super fun.
That would be awesome. It comes full circle.
Mm-hmm.
Started at the bottom, now we're here.
Exactly. Then I can die. you know.
Just, after at that, the casino.
Just, yeah, it's just dead. That's a wrap. John dies.